So without any further ado, I present to you Teddy Carr, our first speaker of the evening.
Thank you very much. Thank you for Tom. My name is Teddy Rowan, and I am an alcoholic. This thing bothers me. I guess the wind be going like this and scares the devil out of me. And I'd like to be like Father Tom, get down there and forget it. I've got a needle in my hand, I'd feel better. However, I can say that finding out I was an alcoholic was one of the grandest things that ever happened to me. I am glad to know, after all the years, that I tried to find out what was wrong with me, what the answer was. I drank, like most people, and during Prohibition, I drank socially for many years. My husband was a very successful businessman, proud people we traveled with, enjoyed drinking, enjoyed doing things. On our weekends, we're drinking, our evenings, we drank. And for many years, I could do this. And I didn't have any problem at all with drinking. But slowly, I began to drink just a little more, just a little faster, and began to feel just a little more miserable in the morning. Now, as this continued, this drinking, I never thought that there was anything. I always felt that I drank too much and I'd have to watch it the next night. Well, it went on, I think, for about 4 years prior to my coming in AA. My drinking really got bad. Then it started, the arguments that start at home. You're drinking too much. Why don't you just have two and stop? Why don't you drink like a lady? This went on. I knew that my husband was right. I knew that my friends were talking. People would be coming to the house for dinner. I would have had a hangover from the night before. I'd go on the wagon every day until 5 o'clock. And at 5 o'clock, I felt free to have a drink to help me get through dinner and to face whatever the evening would bring. I would start at 5 o'clock, mixing scotch, and by the time my husband would get in, I would be loaded. And he'd say, how many drinks did you have? 2 beers. I never had more than 2. I'd be blind. But I didn't realize it didn't take quite just as much liquor as it used to get me high. Something had happened to me. And when he started to criticize me about my drinking, that was the time I became extremely aggressive and abusive. And I didn't know until afterwards why this was. I didn't know that I was worried. I didn't know that what was happening to me. I didn't want it to happen. I knew he was right in everything he said. But because he was right and because I was guilty, I became abusive. I don't need you. I can get along by myself. I'll get a divorce. All loud mouth talk and not a bit of it was meant. Finally, he couldn't take anymore. And I had to go to Reno because he said, you're not dragging me in the gutter. Now, I didn't want that divorce. I loved my husband. I didn't want it. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. I knew he was right. I knew I was wrong. I didn't know why I got drunk when I had just 1 or 2. I would go out to dinner and everybody else would be having fun. Why couldn't I have a drink? I'd order a sherry, maybe after I had been on the wagon for 2 or 3 weeks. Come around, I'd order a sherry, and he'd look at me and say, here we go again. So when the waiter would come the next time, I'll fix you, I'll have a scotch and soda. It was just piling trouble on trouble. And with this trouble was this misery, confusion, bewilderment, and a horrible, deep loneliness that only, I think, another alcoholic can understand. We don't mean it. We don't want to do it. We're ashamed of ourselves. But where can we go? I couldn't go to my family doctor. I'd go down, and I always had a sinus condition. He would give me phenobarbital. Thank God I never get addicted or used to the idea. I was scared to death of pills. But I couldn't tell him what was wrong. If he asked me if I was thinking too much, I'd say, oh, not too much. Why did I do that? I did that because I was ashamed. I was ashamed to let people know just what I was doing. And I didn't realize I was doing it against my will. Reno, a new environment, a new place, lost. And I mean lost. I was out there, and because of being Irish, I think, because of being proud, because of this shame, I wouldn't drink. And I had a very slow build-up. I could go along for maybe 2 or 3 months, drinking slowly, maybe getting a little bit tight one night, but not the... I watched it. I didn't realize it was a form of control that I was making for myself. So that I went on at Reno. No trouble, I worked. But all of a sudden, my drinking picked up again, and I had heard of an AA meeting opening in Reno. But I was too proud to go. I wanted to go. But Reno's a town possibly the size of Plattsburgh. I had many friends there. And I was ashamed to go. From there to San Francisco, from San Francisco, I went out to Hawaii as a dietitian in a plantation hospital. Again, my drinking. Very little in the beginning. And as my drinking accelerated, I got word from my sister that my mother was dying. Well, I didn't know whether she'd live till I got back to New York. And I debated with myself whether I should come back. I knew that if I were in New York, and my husband were in New York, that wouldn't be good for me. I knew that. That was one of the reasons I stayed out there. I was afraid to come back. And finally, thank God, I did come back. I got back on May 1st, 1947, and my mother died May 2nd, 1947. Well, that, I believe, was the thing that emptied the glass. I had had my divorce. My father had died 6 months later. And within a year and a half, both my father, my husband, and my mother. I didn't realize with all this talk I had been doing before, of being a very independent person. It was my life and I'd run it every way, any way I wanted. I didn't think that the rug would come from under me. But anything I ever leaned on, was gone. And for the next 2 months, I was numb. Not so much numb from alcohol. I'm drinking all this time, too. But I'm scared now. I'm frightened. Every time I drank, I got drunk. I went from scotch to rye, bourbon, and finally beer. I thought beer wouldn't affect me. But I couldn't seem to put my hand on anything to pull me together. I prayed. I had a very wonderful mother. And she always would say, Teddy, if it's God's will, you and Toby will be back together again. And I used to say, oh, you have an inside track. You do that praying. I would pray. And the whole time from Reno until I got back to New York, I would say the rosary every night. And I'd be in bed with the rosary and a can of beer beside me, saying, Hail Mary full of grace and a slug of beer in the meantime. I'm making the novena to drink like a lady, and what lady says the rosary with a can of beer? But I meant it. I mean, that's the horrible part of a drunk. no one knows about us. We mean it. We mean it. I meant every word I said. I didn't realize how ridiculous it was. And I think God loves drunks, because I think they're the only people he ever gets to laugh out of. Because he certainly must have laughed. Well, I happened to overhear a conversation. A sister-in-law of mine was talking about some friend of theirs that had joined AA. Now, this was the first time I had heard this word since I left Reno. And I said, well, look, that's for me. And she said, oh, Teddy, you're crazy. She said, you're only upset because you've had a lot of trouble and these things, you're going to be all right. You're not thinking. Of course, you're thinking too much, but I think just as soon as you straighten out and you get over this, you'll be all right. That could be what she thought. But deep down inside, I knew and had known for many years that something was wrong. But what it was, I hadn't an answer. So I got her to agree that she would call AA. That was on a Sunday morning. Well, I felt marvelous. I went to the beach with the rest of the crowd and had a beautiful day. I drank beer until I was numb. But I felt good. I don't know why. And I waited 2 days for the members of the Jackson Heights group to come and visit me. I went to my first meeting in Jackson Heights. And I often, since I've been in AA and have taken care of patients, I've heard people talk about meetings, about good meetings and bad meetings. My first meeting, I shall never forget it. I went to this group, and there was a man with a bright red necktie. Well, they weren't wearing bright red neckties in 1947, it seems to me. And he was there, and I kind of spotted him. And then I had a girl got up, and she was rather young, and every doctor she ever came near chased her all over the place. And she was having trouble that way, and I had enough psychiatry, enough training, and I could more or less tag her. So then, the last chap, Frank Lynch, God love him, he had sold his shoes on the Bowery. These, them, and those. This humility that was for the birds. All of this stuff. And while he's talking, I hear this disturbance in the back and this applause, and this woman is saying, I agree with that. And she staggers up the aisle, dead drunk. I thought it was framed. It was part of the act. Then they get up and they say the Lord's Prayer. I said, oh, Mother of God, what am I into now? But that meeting, believe me, gave me the key, the clue to my life, to my God, and to the happiness which I hope to give others. I got the word allergy. When I heard that word, it rung a bell, because I had had a course in allergies. And I went home and I started to think. And I thought to myself, well now, if you had asthma, you could be sensitive to house dust. And you can't control house dust. So thank God you don't have that. Hay fever, that's the wind and the pollen. You can't control it. Migraine, certain chemicals, certain foods. I'm pretty healthy. It's never bothered me in any way. Then I got down to urticaria, or hives. And I thought, well, if I got darn good and sick eating strawberries, would I eat them? And I said, no. Well, I said, well, here's alcohol. It's giving you mental hives. Fears, indecision, loss of your self-respect, loneliness, terror. These, to me, were mental hives. That was the first sensible thinking I had done since I was born. Sensible in the fact that something applied to me. It seemed to me I had just existed before. I didn't know me. Didn't know what made me tick. Didn't know why I was ticking. That gave me a understanding of the fact that that could be the thing that was bothering me. I had an allergy. And if I left alcohol alone, I might be able to put my life in shape. Shortly afterwards at a meeting, I heard about Knickerbocker. And by this time, I was so grateful, that I wanted to do something. And I'd made up my mind if they didn't take me at Knickerbocker, I was going to go to Bellevue. Because I remembered how lost I was. And the thing I had found, thank God, I wanted to share. Now, people have said, what I have done at Knickerbocker. What I have done at Knickerbocker will never compare with the things that the people of Knickerbocker have done for me. I saw myself in each and every patient. I never knew myself. And these patients, by the mistakes and the actions and the things they did, I began to understand me. I began to understand that I had blamed everything and everyone for the mess I was in, instead of myself. I blamed my husband for letting me down. I didn't realize that I let him down. And if I didn't understand myself, how in God's name could he understand me? I watched the men come in, who after 3 months decided that when they were sober that they could go into a bar and drink Coca-Cola and it wouldn't bother them. They do it for a while, but they always ended up drunk. A drunk has no business in a bar. No business. Because you can get Coca-Cola or soda in an ice cream store. I found out that I had to be honest with myself. And the honesty I had to carry into all my dealings. There weren't any shortcuts. I had to look and admit that I was extremely impatient, extremely intolerant, extremely selfish, that everything had revolved around me and that the rest of the world I never saw. I found out that a theory that explained why a man or a woman got drunk or why I got drunk when I didn't want to get drunk. It's just a theory. It isn't proven. But the fact is, to me, it's logical. And that's the theory of blood sugar. Now, the normal blood sugar runs 80 to 120. And these doctors said that the alcoholic, through an excessive use of alcohol, has disturbed his blood sugar balance, that it's no longer between 80 and 120, but between 50 and 80, which is a low normal. Now, alcohol being a sugar, that when a man went in to take one drink, this would take his blood sugar from 80, would send it up to 90. A half hour later, it would drop it, and he'd have to have another drink. He would have the drink, it would send it up again, and then drop it again. That's where we, when we drink, the more we drink, the thirstier we become. That makes sense, because it happened to me. I'd be blind, and I'd want another drink, and I never knew why. I found that was for the physical side of it. This wouldn't happen unless I put alcohol in my system. The mental obsession. If you think of a drink, you're going to get drunk. Because all action is the result of thought. That book could be on that table until next year. But as soon as I think of it and touch it, I could pick it up because I wasn't to entertain the thought. In entertaining the thought, there was the danger. So with these two things, first of all, I wouldn't get drunk. I wouldn't set up this physical compulsion if I didn't take the first drink. Secondly, if I substituted the thought when the thought occurred to me, I would remove all threats of the action. Humility was a word that I never paid much attention to. I never knew what it meant. And I found out it was teachability. Well, no one could teach me anything. I knew the end of the sentence before you finished it. I still know it. But it was to be taught to listen. And it meant adaptability, to adapt to situations instead of the situations adapting to me. Well, I've made for a fair amount of serenity. It made for serenity for the simple reason that I was no longer fighting situations and things. I was letting the natural course of events take place. And I was trying to handle the only one thing that I had to handle, was myself. Staying sober 24 hours at a time, there's a lot to that. It just doesn't mean staying away from a drink for 24 hours. It means that my thinking must be in order for 24 hours. When I find myself running ahead, looking into the future, worrying about whether I'm going to be drunk next Christmas, what am I going to do over the 4th of July? Everybody else will be drinking and being upset. That would lead to nervousness and tension, and by the time the 4th of July came along, I would be drunk. So that it meant that I lived for today. And if I lived each day, as the day came, did what I could, I wouldn't have a past that I'd be ashamed of. And I wouldn't worry, have to worry about the future, because I'd be taking care of it today. I also learned there about periodics. I was a daily drinker. I didn't know much about periodics. But a periodic is a man or a woman when they're just coming off the bender they're on. They're planning their next one without even knowing it. And they're planning it in this way. They have set up a habit pattern where they're getting drunk every 3 months, and that 3 month period seems to be a very difficult period for people to get over. Well, they set this habit pattern, and what happens, they get off this drunk, and they know when they walk out of a hospital they're going to stay sober, and they don't feel too badly about it. But right in the back of their head, they're saying, well, I'm all right now, but, Doc, I wonder if I'm going to stay sober 3 months from now. I always get drunk, you know. Well, the first week goes by, they're wonderful. They're doing their business, they're going around, they're not paying too much attention, but every now and then it'll flash through their head. Gee, I wonder if I'll make it. Yeah, I gotta make it this time. Well, a month will go by. Then they begin to think a little more of it. This time I gotta make it. Gee, I wonder if I will. I never made it before now. And it gets closer and closer. Finally, a week, 2 weeks before the 3 months are up. I gotta make it. I'm not gonna drink this time. This time it's going to be different. And they build up such attention that they finally start picking up their wives, they pick up their boss, this isn't right, that isn't right, and they're drunk. And the reason they're drunk is that they've never let go of the idea of a drink. They have lived in the future for 3 months, and what they feared happened. This I saw time and time again. Complacency. That sneaks up on us. And And complacency sneaks in when gratitude goes out. And gratitude is something that you have to have, not verbally, but with every breath you have. Because you can be useful. It's nice to see the skies. It's nice to be free. Just the freedom alone that AA has given me. For I no longer have to apologize. I no longer have to lie. I no longer have to be ashamed. I no longer have to walk across the street. I no longer have to fear answering the door. The freedom alone of AA is the most priceless thing you can find. And with that freedom comes gratitude. Gratitude, and gratitude naturally, will turn you to a power higher than yourself. As I said, I prayed. But I never knew God. I always kind of figured him as a great big father that would do whatever I wanted him to do, or he should have done it anyway. But I never realized that he had to be a partner. And I realized I needed a manager. Because I had run my life to a point that I wasn't getting any place. And I was glad to turn it over to anyone or anything that could put some order in it. The 11th step, praying only for the knowledge of His will, the courage to carry it out. To me, God's will is only doing the right thing. And I, as an alcoholic, it's wrong for me to drink. If I'm sincere in doing God's will, I must do what's right for me. God has been extremely good to me. He's given me a gift that I must share with others. He's given me a life. He's given me a purpose. And that purpose is to serve Him through my fellow man. I can't tell you just how grateful and how happy I have been these past almost 10 years. I found out that happiness comes from within by helping those without. Another thing that I learned in AA is something I hadn't done for years, and that was laugh. I think the drunk needs to laugh, and it's many, many years prior to AA that we know what a good laugh is. And I learned to laugh, once again, at Knickerbocker, and I must tell you two of my pet stories. Andy's heard them. But to me, they'll always be good stories. I had never met that hand-wringing type of Irish, oh, the grace of God be with you, and if you open your mouth, they'll take the gold out of your teeth, you know? Well, I had one of these men in there, and I think Dan McGorry might know him. His name was Anthony. So I got to calling him St. Anthony because of this hand-wringing business. So that was fine. A day or so later, I had another drunk come in by the name of Jim Cregan. And Jim was one of the rolling kind. I'd get him into bed and he'd roll on his side, and then I'd get him there and he'd roll here, and the phones were ringing, and I couldn't leave him for fear he'd crack his skull. So I yelled down the hall to this woman who was working with me, and I said, "Ella, get me St. Anthony." And with that, Cregan sat straight up in bed, and he says, "Oh, Mother of God, don't tell me he's here too." The other one was, one day I went on duty around 3:30, and I had about four or five people waiting to talk to me. We had a man there, his wife was there, said, "Sir, phone this man down from Corning, New York." And the poor devil, he had been drunk, and for 3 days he had been complaining about a pain in his belly, and nobody paid a bit of attention to this. They just had to get him down in Knickerbocker and sober him up. So they finally bring him down. We put him to bed, and we find out he has a ruptured appendix. So he's complaining he was so much nicer drunk. You know, he's mad at her because he should have been treated for this, and I have to listen to this, and I'm trying to get an old lady in a home. She didn't have any money. I didn't know where to put her, and the phones are ringing, and a patient had come in just an hour before. And all he wanted was Teddy, please, a little paraldehyde. You know, one of those boys? And all this excitement is going on when the elevator door opened and this piece of fluff came in, much hoop earrings and chiffon scarf, and she says, I want to be one shot, because every time I don't drink or I don't eat, I get drunk, and I just know that I need to be one shot. Zing would go the phone, Teddy, please, a little paraldehyde, I want to be one shot, and finally I had enough. So I said to her, look, if you want an Academy Award, you go to Hollywood. And if you want to get drunk, get the hell out of here and get drunk. And with that, I took my hand back and I grabbed Peraldehyde Pete and I bring him over here and I said, look, there's no whiskey, there's no wine, there's no beer, there's no peraldehyde, there's tomato juice. Go drink it. He said, I married your sister. The tragedy was there, true. But thank God I learned to laugh again. I learned to see the humor in things again. All this has been given to me by AA, every bit of it. And just being here and knowing that so many friends, I tell you, I don't think there's... I had dinner with a chap tonight, Bill from Montreal, and he spoke of the warmth that he found throughout the country as he traveled. I haven't done too much since I've been in AA. But no matter where I've been, and there's been AA, I've been home. God love you all.